The sound of this doorbell may seem pretty ordinary to you, until you realize that it's Graham, who's 75 years old and still delivering meals to people in need in his neighborhood. And that for many of them, it's the most comforting sound they'll hear all day. Seniors bring so much to Quebec. Let's recognize their contribution. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the CJPME Debrief Podcast, a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Together, we discuss developments and issues in Canada's relationship with Palestine and the broader Middle East. Through our conversations, we make sense of events in the region and how people in Canada can respond. Canada's reaction to Russia's invasion of Ukraine last week has been prompt, forceful, and wide-ranging. But there are obvious similarities between Russia's aggression against Ukraine and Israel's aggression against the Palestinians, raising questions about the consistency of Canada's foreign policy. In this episode, we examine Canada's response to Russia's invasion, from condemnations to sanctions to diplomacy to humanitarian support, and compare it to how Canadian leaders respond to Israel's violence, occupation, and annexation of Palestinians. Spoiler alert, there's a huge double standard. My name is Thomas Woodley, president of CJPME, and I'm your podcast host for today. With me is Michael Buchert, CJPME vice president and our podcast co-host. Good afternoon, Michael.
Good afternoon, Tom.
So sort of unusually, we're talking about Russia and the Ukraine quite a bit today, a bit of a change from some of the typical topics, but of course it is relevant for obvious reasons today.
Yeah, I think we've all been watching very closely with some horror as Russia has invaded Ukraine, and there's definitely we don't know yet the scope that this will take, and right. And you know how many people will be affected, and it's hard to look away. And at the same time, I know that a lot of people, especially on social media, are making a lot of comparisons with how they see such a quick, rapid, forceful response to this, and can't help but see the parallel with a lack of response from Canada in the international community when it comes to conflict elsewhere, and especially in the case, I think, of Palestine. And so as we watch this closely, I mean, you just can't help but make those comparisons And so I think it makes sense to talk about some of that here.
Absolutely, absolutely. And for our listeners, we did struggle a little bit about how exactly to scope this discussion here for today, because they're just, the double standards are all over the place. But we've tried to take a focus on the double standards. Foremost, what we're seeing here in Canada with Canadian political leaders. But I guess there are a few things that we wanted to sort of touch on right off the top to make sure that we're not misunderstood. And that, have a caveat, sort of make sure our listeners understand that we don't consider ourselves to be, you know, experts and know-it-alls, and that our comments are not necessarily meant to condone one thing or another with respect to the Canadian response. So first thing right off the bat, I'd like to say that neither Michael nor I purport to be experts on Eastern Europe. We're simply looking at what's going on in Eastern Europe on the basis of a comparison with how Canada and the world has responded to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and to make sense of how Canada decides to respond to major crises.
That's right. And a second thing I think that's important to mention is that when we do discuss some of the measures undertaken by Canada, some of them, you know, which are quite justifiable, I think, we're not assuming that Canada's overall approach to the conflict has been the right one. We know that there are important critiques about the role of NATO in Eastern Europe in particular, as well as years of military aid and training to Ukraine, including working with far-right elements. Canada has also refused to sign the UN treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons, which increasingly looks like a bad decision. You know, there are so many legitimate questions about whether Canada has been doing the necessary things that could have actually de-escalated the conflict and prevented the war. But that, we'll just have to put that aside for now.
That's right, exactly. And, something else we should say is we don't want to appear as insensitive to the suffering and devastation inflicted on the Ukrainians. You know, it's very early in the conflict. Currently, the casualties seem to be in the hundreds, but it could be in a matter of days or weeks or months that the casualties could be in the tens of thousands. And of course, that entirely changes the sort of calculus of how we look at something like this. But we are recording this within what we're Monday today, and the invasion started last Thursday. So we're recording this within 3 or 4 days after the invasion began. Many of the things we'll be discussing were enacted, or the response of Canada and others were enacted within hours or days of when the invasion began. So a lot of what we're looking at is just how rapidly Canadian political leaders and other actors have responded to this. And just on that same point, things are moving very quickly. As I said, you know, things could change very quickly in a few weeks. There could be a massive casualty, something way beyond what we typically see in the Israel-Palestine conflict. So whereas today there might be sort of appropriate comparisons or reasons to look at things in a comparable sort of way, that may change in the coming weeks.
Yeah, exactly. Another important thing is that we're not necessarily endorsing all sanctions taken by Canada or other international actors. Today, there are some extremely broad and wide-ranging sanctions being proposed and implemented against Russia, some which may have serious financial considerations, may have serious consequences in terms of a humanitarian crisis for the civilian population. We've seen devastating sanctions placed on other countries. I mean, in particular, Iraq in the 90s, and I mean, Iran today even, which really hurt the civilian population. So not all sanctions are equal, and we do need to consider these things on their own merits.
Yeah, it's actually quite interesting. Just in my lifetime, attitudes towards sanctions have changed dramatically. So yeah, very, very, very important point there to make there. But overall, the point being that we can learn a lot from Canada's response to the Russian invasion compared to Canada's lack of action on Israel's military invasions and occupation of the Palestinians, including annexation and so on, and airstrikes. So we have put together a list that Michael and I wanted to go through. It's a high-level list. And so we'll just walk through these different things with primarily a focus on Canada's response to these things. So, you know, Michael, I think both of us were sort of struck by how quickly the Canadian government condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine, again, within hours. I have a quote here from Justin Trudeau, his statement, Canada condemns in the strongest possible terms Russia's egregious attack on Ukraine. These additional unprovoked actions are another clear and further violation of Ukraine's sovereignty, territorial integrity, and independence. They are also a violation of Russia's obligations under international law and the Charter of the United Nations. He goes on, Russia's attack on Ukraine is also an attack on democracy, on international law, on human rights, and on freedom. It threatens peace and order in Europe and around the world. So very powerful statements, very wide, you know, sweeping statements.
Yeah, and pretty consistently from Canadian officials to, in fact, immediately as the events were unfolding during the initial moments of the invasion, Canada's ambassador to the UN, Paul Bray, was tweeting wildly, very like honestly and personally about the significance of this, and almost in a personal capacity, and clearly are quite you know horrified and personally moved by this, and they're showing just a capacity for outrage that we just have not seen in any other case.
No, I mean, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, and in particular in the case of whenever Israel commits something that might be considered similar, if you even get a response, it's you know, calling on all sides to de-escalate, or, you know, rarely even names Israel as an actor in these sort of flare-ups of conflict. So to see the government consistently using such strong language in this case is really quite shocking. It's like, oh, they can do it. They actually have the means to call out violations of whatever. Yeah. They can call out a military occupation or annexation and call them as violations of international law. They can do it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, imagine how preposterous it would be if they came out today and said, we call on all sides, Ukraine and Russia, to, you know, cease hostilities. You know, it just, you know, and yet they refused, as you say, they often refuse to even mention Israel in it when they talk about conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. And, you know, one of my pet peeves all along has, and it's not just for the governing liberals or the government, is that quite often all of Canada's political parties are very hesitant to make condemnations, to hold Israel to account in their statements. Once I was, you've heard this story, I know, Michael, but once I was talking to Paul Dewar, who for many years was the foreign affairs critic for the NDP, and I said, Paul, when was the last time you condemned Israel for its expansion of settlements? And he says, Tom, well, you know, I oppose settlements. And I said, but when was the last time? But Tom, you know, we've done it in the past. And I said, but when was the last time? And so there's just this resistance or this reluctance to actually name Israel as an aggressor, to name Israel and its violations. You know, I know that Trudeau's statement here is also in a violation of Russia's obligations under international law and the Charter of the United Nations. And that's you know, that's one of Israel's. I think quite often we have to cite the Charter of the United Nations to talk when we talk about Israel and how they are not respecting international law and their obligations under the Charter of the United Nations. We can talk more about that later. But yeah, I just, it's like you say, you know, if they can, they actually can do it. They actually can condemn countries when they feel like it, when they choose to.
Yeah. And maybe here's a quote, maybe to give another example from Melanie Joly, Minister of Foreign Affairs. Again, just to give a sense of the flavor here that you don't see anywhere else. Yeah. Today is a dark day. Russia's further invasion of Ukraine is a fundamental challenge to the world order that has kept us safe since the Second World War. The fight is in Ukraine, but the threat extends far past its borders. Canada and our partners have been clear. These reckless and dangerous acts will not go unpunished. The sanctions being imposed today will work in coordination with those from our partners to inflict severe costs to the Russian regime.
Yeah. So, right, exactly. So, you know, so they are using the tools at their disposal to put pressure on Russia. And they could do the very same thing with Israel if they chose to.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they choose not to. So a second area where we see, where we both of us sort of observe this double standard is the way Canada has responded in a humanitarian way towards the Ukraine. Very quick, I guess, as of Friday, I got an announcement from the Department of Global Affairs saying that the federal government would match donations to the Red Cross for up to $10 million. So from private donations from Canadians, matched up to $10 million. And that was, well, I guess, the day after the invasion began. So, I mean, one thing that we've already mentioned, and I think we'll be repeating it throughout this podcast, is just the rapidity of the response. Literally, you know, 24 hours after the invasion began, Canada is offering this matching funds program for humanitarian and for Ukraine. And of course, that's in addition to some of the other aid that the government is also offering. Maybe do you want to go through some of that, Michael?
Well, I mean, I don't even know where to start. They have all these different matching donations programs to the Ukraine Humanitarian Crisis Appeal of the Red Cross. They have given $50 million in funding to Ukraine for development and humanitarian aid already. And they have announced $620 million in sovereign loans, again, to the Ukrainian government. Yeah. So it's pretty. And then there's, you know, the Ontario government, Doug Ford as well, announced $300,000 from Ontario to the Canada-Ukraine Foundation. And the New Democrats in Ontario are pushing for more. They're calling it a pittance and want at least $3 million from Ontario. And this is in days, as you mentioned. I look back last year during the events in May when Israel was assaulting Gaza, Canada did end up coming up with humanitarian aid, but it was weeks later. It was after the ceasefire. Yeah. I think almost a week after the ceasefire had come into effect, and then they finally announced some humanitarian aid, and it came to a total of $20 million. So again, it's I think we're going to continue to see a lot more here, but more than the dollar amount, it really is the urgency,
yeah,
and just the willingness to act immediately to respond to genuine needs.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's one of the things that we put in a lot of our policy documents, isn't it? That Canada needs to respond with more urgency with respect to the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. When you were mentioning about the Ford government and Andrea Horwath and the Ontario NDP, and you know, would Ford or Horwath ever suggest humanitarian aid for Palestinians? Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah, it's hard to imagine. One thing as well, I mean, it was, we certainly should be appreciative of the humanitarian aid that Canada offered last year in May for the Palestinians. Although my reading of it, it wasn't all earmarked for the Palestinians in Gaza, and it was additional money sort of going to existing programs through existing channels. So it in as much as it was to some degree a response to the suffering that was inflicted upon Palestinians in May, it to some degree the government will often sort of, you know, announce the same aid twice or fold things into existing programs, and you don't really get the impact as if there were sort of a new program put in place with a new burst of funding with sort of this urgency. So we are certainly thankful for the Canadian gesture last year, but it's just with an entirely, we see an entirely different tone and urgency here in terms of the crisis in Ukraine. I guess we also want to talk about the Canadian response to Ukrainian refugees. The first thing I saw in terms of response to this was, again, it was last Friday, I believe. I saw an interview of Doug Ford, and he was urging the Canadian government to take a tougher line on Russia. But in addition to accept more Ukrainian refugees. So again, really surprising the response on that and how quickly. I guess as well, you had, again, as early as I think the article I was looking at was from Saturday, Defense Minister Anita Anand has said that there are a number of options on the table for getting Ukrainian refugees to Canada. On Thursday, actually, literally hours after the invasion had begun, Justin Trudeau, our prime minister, was saying the Canadian government will be prioritizing immigration applications for Ukrainians. So really just, I mean, we should applaud this in terms of it is good that the Canadian government has reacted so quickly. But, you know, you consider how that compared to Canada's reaction to the crisis in Syria and how long it took Canada to respond in terms of, you know, putting in place programs for Syrian refugees. You know, we're just within hours or days of when this crisis has started. And there's really no way of knowing how big the Ukrainian refugee crisis will be. And yet the government is sort of putting itself out there so early.
Yeah, and I think we should look at Canada as a quick response to this as well in context with the European response to Ukrainian refugees as well, which has been overwhelming and like very welcoming, but in a way that is like in such a sharp contrast with how they have treated refugees from elsewhere, including from Syria, from other countries, from non-European countries. It's just an incredible double standard. And I mean, we can save this for maybe a different time when we talk about media responses, but there's so many comments you see about how it's like these people look like us and they drive the cars that we do and they watch Netflix, and then the people are just so much more willing to step up and just welcome them in compared to non-European refugees who have, you know, humanitarian needs just like anyone else. So, you know, it's definitely noticeable and worth paying attention to.
Yeah. You know, I'm also reminded of the Canadian response to Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 2006. Now, Canada did eventually put in place a program to evacuate Canadians from Lebanon in 2006. But it took many weeks before Canada started, you know, to sort of jump into action. And it's slightly different there. They were evacuating Canadians from Lebanon. But just the as we keep saying, the rapidity of the response, the urgency of the response is just what is so striking. And yet in the Middle East, quite often they're so deliberative, in their reaction. So I guess the next area that we wanted to talk about was on the sanctions side. And what's interesting is there'll be a lot of comparisons that we'll be able to go through in terms of, you know, of course, how the world and how specifically Canada and the Canadian political leaders have responded to calls to put economic pressure of various sorts on Israel. So let's talk first about trade sanctions that Israel is imposing on Russia on Friday. Justin Trudeau, he announced that Canada will be imposing additional sanctions under special economic measures regulations, and they were to be there are a few dozen Russian individuals who will be sanctioned, who will have their assets frozen, members of the Russian Security Council, including the defense minister, the finance minister, the justice minister. They also decide to restrict exports to Russia by halting new export permits. And they also canceled, I guess, about 700 million in existing export permits. And that's a story on its own. But let's just talk, I guess, to start with, in terms of this sort of sanctioning of Russian individuals and entities, which is quite interesting. Do you want to start with things to say, Michael, or should I just continue?
Well, it's hard to know what to say. I feel like every day they're strengthening these measures and we're hearing about new sanctions. I think they're now sanctioning President Putin as well. But there's constantly every day new sanctions being implemented on officials. And I mean, that's an interesting approach. There's nothing, you know, wrong with that. That can be very useful for putting real pressure on the regime and its members. It's interesting that there are no consequences like this when it comes to human rights violations in Israel, despite similar actions that could be considered war crimes under international law, especially airstrikes in civilian areas in Gaza. Organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International have been calling for governments to put sanctions on individual officials like this in this exact same way, in order to hold them accountable and to hold them accountable for these violations, which amount to crimes of even apartheid under international law. So it's a good mechanism, and we should be using it consistently and not only selectively and sort of overwhelmingly in this case, where this is an opponent of Canada rather than a close friend and ally. But it provides, I guess, maybe an example or a precedent for what could be imposed in the case of Israeli officials if we actually wanted to take that problem seriously and be responsible.
Yeah. Well, and at some level with some of these Russian officials, it's almost academic. These people are, they don't travel much to Canada, whereas Israeli officials are regularly coming to Canada, regularly visiting Western nations. And I think there have been stories where, certain European countries, when you have sort of a progressive government in place, and Israeli officials start being, well, maybe I shouldn't visit Spain, or maybe I shouldn't visit this other country because they might arrest me. And so this is really can be quite, I think, quite intimidating to leaders of, rogue regimes or leaders of countries who are committing these abuses. It can be quite intimidating to sort of feel like, gosh, I could be picked up at any moment if I travel internationally. And I think this is the type of pressure that should be put on Israeli leaders. And yet, here, despite calls from the Palestinians, despite, as you say, copious reports from the major human rights organizations about the potentially war crimes of some of these individuals, Western governments, including Canada, refuse to issue these types of things. In fact, the Amnesty report that came out last month actually talked about Canada exercising universal jurisdiction, which is exactly that, right? That you can actually then arrest leaders of a foreign country with this jurisdiction, given that many of these individuals are accused of war crimes.
Yeah, exactly. It's also, I think, important to note that since Russia annexed the Ukrainian territory of Crimea in 2014, Canada has actually sanctioned more than 440 individuals and entities, taking their freezing their assets and prohibiting dealings with these people. Israel has annexed territory, including East Jerusalem. I mean, they occupied East Jerusalem in 1967, annexed it in the early 1980s. Mm-hmm. No one in the world, except for perhaps the U.S. and a couple of other minor countries, considered that to be Israeli territory. They considered it to be illegal. And yet there isn't a single sanction or any other measure comparable to this that Canada has implemented in response to that. So, and in fact, as we talk about a lot, Canada has a free trade deal that applies to this territory, so that settlement businesses in East Jerusalem and other annexed territory actually can benefit from privileged trade deals with us. So we're doing the exact opposite of sanctions for in this case specifically, the exact same crime under international law with maybe even less sort of legitimacy. So yeah. I think, again, this is another case where the double standard just couldn't be clearer.
Yeah, absolutely. And we can't move off of this point before we talk about the fact how, on a moment's notice, Canada canceled export permits worth $700 million to Russia. And yet, after years and years of pressure, they refuse to cancel export permits to Saudi Arabia.
That's right.
Just mind-blowing. That supposedly with Saudi Arabia, there were sort of conditions built in that they couldn't, of course, nobody actually gets to see these export permits. No one actually gets to see these contracts to actually judge that for themselves. We just we're told to trust the government. The government has been, media have given the government all sorts of proof. Media and arms experts have given the government all sorts of proof of how Saudi Arabia is likely misusing or will likely misuse the technology that Canada is providing, and yet they refused to cancel those export permits. And yet, in literally hours, they were able to do so with Russia.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, the case in Yemen is really, really awful. It's the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Canada continues to sell billions in weapons every year, as you say, especially through this deal to Saudi Arabia, which is imposing a blockade and constant airstrikes on the civilian population. It really is a horrifying situation that also is really another good example of a double standard. And even in that case, too, Canada will consistently condemn militants in Yemen, will mm-hmm. never, ever criticize the Saudi government or coalition allies in the airstrikes that have caused so much harm. And again, is creating this humanitarian, really terrible crisis. So it's just, it's so discouraging, you know, when you put it side by side.
Yeah.
To see how little these principles actually mean to the Canadian government. It's only when they want to use them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And we should probably mention also the banking sanctions that Canada and other Western leaders have imposed on the Russians. Canadian financial institutions are now barred from doing any transactions with Russia's central bank. This may be appropriate. On the other hand, why has, you know, similar pressure not been put on Israel after its years of violations, its years of occupation, you know, against the Palestinians? It just, you know, it defies explanation.
Mm-hmm. Although in this case, I think there is more reason to be worried about this kind of sanction. The central bank, I mean, basically this means that as Russia's economy is crumbling, and I think their currency fell by like 30% today, and Russians are going to lining up, doing a run on banks, essentially, and it could be a horrible financial crisis, very broad-based and not targeted. What this does is means that Russia can't draw upon emergency reserves around the world, like in Canada, to sort of correct for that crisis. So, which means that it can't do anything to stave off a financial collapse if that is what's happening. So this is one of those policies that maybe it's justified if we look at the details, but I think there's a huge risk that this might be overreach and may actually be contributing to a worsening situation. I hope that's not the case.
Yeah.
But unlike many of the other sanctions that we're talking about, which are far more targeted, make a lot more sort of clear-cut sense.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. And I think in terms of pressuring a government, as we said in the opening, you want to make sure that the sanctions aren't done in such a way that, you know, I don't think Russian Vladimir Putin, I don't think he'll be missing a meal, or, you know, he won't be suffering through a blackout or anything like that. It's going to be more the average Russian who will probably suffer from these things. But there are systematic and more progressive ways to do this. I guess the point here being more that just, you know, this is something that could have been done to Israel years ago in a progressive, in a way which, you know, wouldn't necessarily hurt the citizens of a country, but would put pressure on the leaders of the country to change their behavior. And yet we've never seen that sort of action when it comes to Israel-Palestine. Of course, on the broader, we don't need to spend too much time on this, but of course, more broadly, to your point, I guess Western powers have put the bans on the SWIFT banking system, whereby international transactions are carried out, which will have a huge impact, of course, on the Russian economy. Anything else we should say about that?
In addition to sort of these pretty broad sanctions on banking, on finances that go beyond just targeting individuals' financial accounts, there's this interesting op-ed that I find actually kind of alarming in the Globe and Mail, mm-hmm. where among others, Lloyd Axworthy and Fenn Hampson and Ratna Amidvar, they're writing about how actually here's the title: "Let's Seize, Not Freeze, the Wealth of Putin's Cronies." So saying that it's not enough just to put a hold on these on the wealth that is in, say, Canadian banks, but actually we should be expropriating that That's quite a significant thing if we actually did that. I don't know if there's any legal basis for doing that kind of thing. I mean, taking money from oligarchs and giving it for directing it towards more social purposes, maybe there's an argument there, but just taking someone's money is certainly an interesting thing to propose.
Yeah, it seems very arbitrary, right? A little bit, and that again, I think that op-ed came out Friday or Saturday, so you know, hardly a moment's notice, and we're already saying let's seize this money. Quite interesting, quite extreme. Let's look at the question of divestment. I was actually surprised to see very early on, and I believe it was actually Thursday, the Caisse de dépôt de placement de Québec. It's one of Canada's biggest pension funds, the Quebec Public Pension Fund. They said Thursday that it had sold its positions in Russia and would avoid exposure to the country as it faces additional sanctions. Now, folks that aren't familiar with it, in French, it goes by the acronym CDPQ, CDPQ in French. CJPME, we've actually been looking at the CDPQ in terms of whether or not we should try to pressure it. And part of the reason is that the CDPQ has a huge investment in Allied Universal, which has owned G4S since April 2021. And G4S, of course, is a security firm which is highly involved in Israel's occupation of the Palestinians. So we were sort of looking at ways to sort of put pressure on the CDPQ to divest from Allied Universal. And here, you know, but we were sort of gearing up for a very long and arduous sort of battle. And yet here, literally hours after Russia invades Ukraine, the CDPQ has already liquidated its assets that were based in Russia. So it's just mind-blowing, isn't it?
Yeah, and we've seen calls for divestment pretty broadly, including in the United States. The state of Colorado, they issued an executive order to divest the state from any Russian-owned assets and actually encouraged universities to do the same thing. Other initiatives from legislators are being proposed in Pennsylvania, New York, all of these states. This is the thing. All of these states have anti-BDS laws, which means a few years ago, they passed legislation to punish people, to prohibit dealings with organizations and entities that support the boycott of Israel for the same human rights reasons. Those who want either to boycott products or to divest, to sell funds in Israeli companies. So on one hand, they're saying BDS is absolutely not the right way forward when it comes to international conflicts. This is to the point of not just rejecting it, but actually creating effectively sanctions against people who want to take up these nonviolent strategies. But on the other hand, they're saying, but in this case, actually, this is the perfect thing to do. And again, this was like a day or two into the invasion. So there's something interesting happening here where there's this adoption of tactics of BDS in a pretty broad scale way. And suddenly all of these people who were saying, that they were inappropriate tactics to use against Israel in support of Palestinians are perfectly acceptable and appropriate tools that we should immediately adopt in the case of Russian aggression. Yeah. So doesn't seem like a consistent application. But it's interesting, and I do wonder if by sort of adopting this, and you know, if Canada and you know if institutions around the world are adopting this as this is an appropriate tool in response to human rights violations, maybe then we can convince more Canadians as well that if we can apply it to Russia, we can apply it to Israel as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think this is. One of the things that I think members of the Palestine Solidarity Movement should keep these things in mind when we're talking to policymakers in the future and to show these parallels, just as you suggested. Now, one of the things that I'm sure that you'll hear back from policymakers is that these situations are entirely different, and we may want to do a podcast at some point in the future, sort of so that some people might believe that they are different for this reason and this reason and this reason, but they're actually very similar for these reasons. So this might actually, that might be something, an interesting topic to explore for a podcast. What will be the arguments of the other side to say that these two situations are entirely different, and what will be our response to them? But that's something maybe for another podcast. I guess we also enumerated a number of interesting cases or developments in terms of a cultural boycott, right, of Russia. Now here we're going a little bit beyond the Canadian borders, but there's such interesting examples that I think it's worth it. I guess something I came across over the weekend is that the Eurovision Song Contest organizers decided to exclude Russia from their 2022 competition. And that's sort of interesting because, of course, many of our listeners may know that Israel is actually has been a member of the Eurovision Song Contest for many years. I guess a few years ago, it won it. And there's been, over the years, the Eurovision Song Contest has actually been a target for people in the BDS movement to sort of say, Eurovision, you need to be excluding Israel. And here, literally a day or two after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Eurovision is taking this same action against Russia.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, even Eurovision took place in Israel a couple of years ago, I think near Tel Aviv, on the ruins of a Palestinian village.
Yeah.
So, and of course, at the time, you know, calls for boycotts for politics had no place. In fact, if I remember correctly, the Icelandic delegation held up a Palestinian flag at one point while they were sitting in the stands, and were actually, I think, fined by Eurovision for bringing into a political act into the proceedings. So a pretty dramatic change of heart, I guess, on behalf of Eurovision. But similarly, again, in the arts, a Russian conductor was dropped almost immediately, within a day, I think, by the Vienna Philharmonic's U.S. tour. Apparently, he was a friend of Putin, and he wouldn't take a clear position against this invasion. But when we see other cultural boycotts like this, when it comes to, urging an Israeli production to be dropped from a festival or that kind of thing, or in Australia, there was a huge battle over the Sydney Festival, which took money from the Israeli government to finance a production, we're always told, well, there's no place for politics in the arts. This is the last place you want to get into divisive issues and excluding people based on politics. Clearly, that is not the case when it comes to Russia. Similarly, a number of ballet performances and tours across the UK have been canceled because they were with Russian ballet companies. There's also a huge number of sports boycotts, I could mention. The International Olympic Committee is urging international sports federations to either move tournaments if they're taking place in Russia, or just cancel them, or even to bar Russian athletes from competing in events. Mm-hmm. Just today, I heard FIFA is apparently suspending the Russian team from participating in I think the European Cup, whatever that is. Tournaments canceled, players banned in sports related to badminton, swimming, tennis, formula run, racing, judo, all sorts of things. That's coming very, very quick.
Yeah. And I guess I see something, I think it was yesterday, where I think Sweden and Norway and I think the UK teams in the FIFA European Cup said that they would refuse to play Russia.
Right.
That was interesting, too. Now, what's interesting is that you do once in a while see that in the Middle East and North Africa, that once in a while you'll see a sports team refuse to compete against Israel, given Israel's abuses. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that the Palestinian FIFA leadership has asked FIFA to sanction Israel, to exclude Israel from things, because not only is Israel occupying the Palestinians and carrying out a brutal occupation, they also, I guess, one of the main complaints by the Palestinians is that Israel's FIFA, their various leagues, they actually have soccer teams that are involved in the FIFA organization, which are actually based in Israeli settlements, which is, of course, Palestinian land. And yet, even with that, of course, there's people who followed this over the years. There's been a bit of back and forth, and every once in a while, the FIFA seems poised to actually sanction Israel in some way, and then they back away from it, or they find an excuse not to. So again, it's just striking to see how definitive, how trenchant these decisions are on the half of these sporting agencies, sporting bodies, including FIFA, and how reluctant these same sporting bodies are when it comes to sanctioning Israel for its treatment of the Palestinians.
Yeah, in fact, just when it comes to individuals or individual teams who decide not to compete against Israeli athletes, which is the case with countries like Algeria or Malaysia, right. Sometimes that'll happen every once in a while. Usually those teams are subject to huge penalties, right. Financial fines or that kind of thing. For doing it, they're punished for taking that kind of an action. So I guess maybe it's too early to see whether these teams will also be punished for saying that they won't play against Russia. Maybe not.
Right. Well, not only punished, but also held up to scorn by Western media. Look, this Algerian, judo player, he refused to compete against an Israeli judo. It's and just they're held up to scorn by international media when they do that, and yet they're standing on principle, just as presumably Swedish and Norwegian and British soccer players are. I probably want to bring things to a close relatively soon, but I guess there's two more things that we should touch on. We want to touch on this interesting reaction by provincial liquor boards. Who want to react, and then we'll do one more point after that, and we'll call it a wrap for this podcast. So I guess, again, very quickly, as early as Friday, so a day after the invasion began, the Ontario LCBO, which is the Ontario Liquor Board, was ordered to remove all Russian whiskey from their stores.
Vodka, probably.
Yeah, vodka, foremost vodka. So the finance minister of Ontario said, "The people of Ontario will always stand against tyranny and oppression. To that end, I'm directing the LCBO to withdraw all products produced in Russia from store shelves." And that, of course, Stephen Del Duca, who's one of the Liberal leaders in Ontario, he sort of stood with that. He encouraged that. He said, "We must send a clear message to Putin, including halting all money going to Russia during his Ukraine invasion and removing all Russian vodka from the LCBO shelves." So pretty striking. I guess you'll be one to point out some of the ways in which this contracts with another case, which is before the LCBO, aren't you?
I guess I was a bit taken aback by how quickly this happened, because it was within a day or two of the invasion that immediately, not just Ontario, but following that, Quebec, BC, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Manitoba, but across the country, they're just removing these Russian products from the shelves immediately. And at the same time, you can find at the LCBO or elsewhere products from Israel, and not just from Israel, but for example, wine that is produced on illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territory against international law. Yeah, effectively, you can purchase the products of war crimes at the liquor store at the same time as you can't get Russian products. And that it's not like people don't know that this is happening. There was a lawsuit at the federal level to stop basically allowing settlement wine to be labeled as products of Israel. And there was actually a positive outcome. A federal judge said that if you call these things produced in occupied territory as product of Israel, that's false and misleading and deceptive. But said that they can't do that anymore. The Liberal government, Justin Trudeau, actually took this to court. They appealed that decision. And I'm not exactly sure where that stands now, but the government did all it could to make sure that you could still purchase these settlement wines at your store, and they would be called Israeli products to protect these settlement businesses. It's really an incredible, I guess, difference in reaction.
Yeah, Yeah. Well, and again, you know, so the government right now in Ontario is a conservative government, and when the conservatives were in the minority, I guess it was in 2017, right? The conservative government tried to pass a was it a motion or a law to penalize people who promoted the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. So these very same people that are saying, you know, we need to immediately sanction Russia in our LCBO, they were the ones just trying to pass a law that's saying it will be outlaw the possibility of boycotting Israel. So just the double standard there is just mind blowing.
I also one thing that I'd really like to note is that all of these calls for boycotts, from alcohol to other sanctions, they're not boycotting Russia's presence in Ukrainian territory. They are boycotting Russia. And just in the same way as when we talk about boycotting Israel, some people say that it's inappropriate to boycott Israel, but it's okay to boycott Israeli settlements because that's separate. Those are illegal. It's not Israeli territory. And they make this distinction. Of course, it doesn't make any sense because Israel is the government that is settling the territory.
Right.
It is the it's not the occupation. The government is the one that is doing the occupation. So that logic never made sense. But it's very clear in this case that nobody is making that kind of distinction to try to say only Crimean products, Russian products in Crimea or the Donbass, those right. are what we have to target, and anything else is totally illegitimate. So.
Well, right. And I mean, another point you could make on top of that is to some degree, you know, Putin seems to have a lot of top-down power, top-down control. You know, so by actually sanctioning Russia as a whole, you know, you are sanctioning, to some degree, the Russian population is suffering, even though it seems largely a decision on the part of Putin to carry out this invasion. Whereas Israel, which is always proudly says that it's a democracy and everyone's involved and everyone has a voice. Well, so really the Israeli people are electing election after election these right-wing governments. So, you know, very much so they are to some degree as a population much more accountable for the policies of their government, more so even than you could say is the Russia is, it seems at this point. I mean, again, we're not experts on Eastern Europe, but just from afar, that's the way it looks to me.
Yeah. So definitely, I think when it comes to some of these arguments about sort of narrowing the space that is legitimate for boycott actions, I think this blows this all out of the water. Clearly, it doesn't. You know, we're not nitpicking about exactly where these products are produced, whether it's legitimate. If a state is committing violations of international law and human rights, it's legitimate to boycott that state.
Right. I think the last I think we do want to wrap things up here. So we'll jump to one final point, which is something that has always troubled me a little bit about the liberal government that we have right now. Is that they talk a lot about, you know, the international rules-based order. Chrystia Freeland recently, I guess on Thursday, she said we cannot allow this to be the end of the post-World War II rules-based order. And she says these types of things frequently. And yet you sort of say, well, okay, but what about when this rules-based order is repeatedly violated by Israel? You know, Chrystia Freeland, at another occasion, she said we have this vital international norm that no country should be allowed to alter its borders by force. And she's talking, this was past Thursday, today's sanctions demonstrate that Canada and the international community are ready to impose costs on Russia when it ignores international law and the rules-based international order. Another op-ed I saw on this was talking about, you know, how this rules-based order has protected, quote unquote, protected democracies from domination by stronger powers. You know, the Palestinians held a democratic election in 2006. It was rejected by the international community. Israel has, of course, dominated the Palestinians for years. Why isn't anyone concerned about the rules-based order when it comes to Israel? And I guess what bothers me personally a bit about this is that this is something that's a point that is so frequently raised by Chrystia Freeland and Justin Trudeau, and yet the double standard here is just blinding.
Yeah, there's such a conviction here that You know, the rules-based order, this international law is so important. There has to be consequences for when those rules are broken, and those consequences are so severe. But we've just been looking the other way for decades when it comes to Israel's violations. Selling them arms, modernizing our free trade agreement with Israel, all of these different things, voting against most resolutions at the UN would criticize these violations, effectively protecting Israel from criticism over these things.
Right.
Absolutely. Clearly, they don't care about the rules-based international order. If they did, they'd be putting in real consequences for these things.
Yeah. And, you know, to be fair, we're not the first to figure this out. And to his credit, Michael Link pointed this out when Russia was sanctioned after it annexed the Crimea in 2014. Michael Link sort of highlighted this, and he said, look, when Russia annexed the Crimea, Russia was expelled from the G8. There was an import and export ban imposed on the goods manufactured in Crimea. There's a whole range of sanctions against Russia against individuals there as well. Travel bans were imposed on them as well. But he said, look, and literally, quote, there is no daylight between the Russian annexation of Crimea and the Israeli annexation of any of the territory it conquered in 1967 from the Palestinians. For Canada to remain silent, this is Michael Link speaking, it tells me that Canada is applying different standards to situations that are essentially the same. So, you know, just highlighting something that Michael Link himself pointed out several years ago, that, you know, the parallels are there, but the reaction is entirely different. I guess that's sort of what I wanted to cover, Michael. Should we leave it at that for today? I think we've covered a lot of ground. Should we call it a wrap there? Or anything else you want to say before we wrap it up here?
I guess we haven't touched on everything because there has been such an overwhelming response to Russia's actions. Like, we could also talk about there a possible investigation by the International Criminal Court that Canada would almost certainly support. A possible investigation by the International Court of Justice, which Canada would almost certainly support. Canada will be voting this week at the United Nations, at the General Assembly, to condemn Russia's actions while voting against all motions that criticize Israel. There's so many, at every level of society almost, there has been a response that we never see applied to other conflicts, and particularly in the case of the occupation and Israeli apartheid in Palestine. So we could keep talking about this, but I think we've made our point. That when it comes to these, most of the things we discussed are completely legitimate and useful and appropriate responses to violations. Our issue is not with them, but with the double standards and the inability to consistently apply this to all to all places where we need to take action.
Yeah, exactly. We'll see how things evolve in the coming days. We may do another podcast on other aspects of this. And thank you, Michael.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal, and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
This piano piece may well sound ordinary to you, until you realize that it was taught to young Chloe just last week by Janet, who's still teaching at 81. Seniors bring so much to Quebec. Let's recognize their contribution. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Listening to CKUD in Montreal!
Try wiggling, you could try swallowing.